if you're stuck, if you're struggling, if you're being dismantled, if you feel like your life is getting pulled out from underneath you, I say, congratulations. Like, what a fucking opportunity that is. You are being given an opportunity to look at yourself and reconstruct your life from the ground up. Not everybody gets that opportunity. Like, lean into it. Our instinct is to shun it or avoid it or pretend it's not there. But the truth is, there's this incredible gift if you move towards it.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. By trade and training, I'm a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. Now, the whole idea behind this podcast, behind these conversations, is to learn from people who have committed their life efforts towards mastery. Now, we're much more interested in that blending between mastery of self and mastery of craft. And we also want to dig to understand, what is the tension between those two? What are the specific and unique ways that they're going at building their craft? But more importantly, how are they mastering the inner life? How do they organize their thinking? How do they organize their inner life to pursue the very best of themselves? And that usually involves something about purpose. It usually involves something about dealing with uncertainty. And also, like, how do they manage when things don't go according to plan? That's all about the inner life. That's about the psychological skills to be able to pivot and adjust. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus, their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product, and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's hims.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. HIMS.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's conversation is with a legend, Rich Roll. If you've listened to this podcast for a while, you know his name. This is the third time we've had him on the podcast. And he's someone I love getting the chance to sit and learn and talk and converse with. And he's got a way about himself that is open and learned. So he's got that right blend between the two. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Rich, he was named as one of the 25 fittest men in the world by Men's Fitness and the world's fittest vegan by Men's Health. Rich is a globally renowned ultra endurance athlete, and I don't throw that globally around very often. He is globally renowned as an ultra endurance athlete, a wellness advocate, he's a best-selling author, he's a husband and a father of four. He also, prior to much of that, graduated from Stanford University and Cornell Law School. Now, the way that he and I first met is that he hosts the Rich Roll podcast, and that's one of the top 100 podcasts in the world. And Rich is, in fact, the reason I started this podcast. So there's much that I owe him. He's got a new book coming out titled Voicing Change, and that's set for release in November of 2020. He's also got a couple of previous books that I think you're really going to like, Finding Ultra, if you're not familiar with him, but then one that I think is a game changer for families. Certainly, if you're down the path on conscious eating, he and his wife wrote a cookbook and lifestyle primer. It's called The Plant Power Way, whole food, plant-based recipes and guidance for the whole family. And I felt it was incredibly timely to speak to Rich again, and for one reason. He knows what rock bottom feels like. I don't say that lightly. And he found a way to put his life back together. And I wanted to get a feel for how he is approaching the uncertainty of this year. And in light of what his past experiences have taught him, how he's able to respond when things feel like they're closing in, collapsing from the sides, if you will. And that's something that many of us are feeling, certainly when it comes to business and or health and or messages from politics, which we get into good conversations about all that. And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with the legend, Rich Roll. Rich, how are you?
I'm good. And I will say up front, normally, it's much more relaxing to be a guest on a podcast than to be a host, but maybe not with you.
Here we go. Yeah. Come on. Oh, hey, listen, I want to start by saying I'm incredibly grateful for you. And so the reason I'm incredibly grateful is because we met maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and maybe longer. And that day changed me. And so you had me on your show, which anybody who's not familiar with the Rich Roll podcast, please go check it out. And so you had me on your show, and I loved the way that you handled the experience of a long form interview. And it was organic, and it was deep, and it was rich, and it gave me a chance to share, as opposed to trying to have to get the right, you know, little bits in place to get the sound bite right, because you never quite know what's going to go next. And so I was like, this is a beautiful experience. So you're the reason I have a podcast.
I appreciate that. You did the work, though. You've created something phenomenal. I'm glad that I helped ignite that spark. I remember reading about you. I think it was perhaps your work with Felix and Stratos that caught my attention initially. And I was like, who is this guy? I got to find this guy. I tracked you down. And I was like, hey, man, you got to come on my thing. And you're like, what is this? And I'm like, why? You're like, you're sort of a reluctant.
You totally was. what is this?
Yeah.
And so I love the serendipity of it. And then, over the years to get to know you as a person, man, I love sitting down with you, learning from you. And I think this is meant to be the highest compliment is that you without words changes people. So I feel that even when you don't say things, just your presence and the way that you present your curiosity and your essence, I feel it. And so to me, the way that I make sense of that is that you've done a lot of work on you.
I'm going to try to take that in, but I feel my imposter syndrome flaring up right now. I'm resisting the impulse to tell you why you're wrong about all of those things.
No, man. Yeah. Sometimes you just got to take it, I know. Yeah. So let's just kind of play with that. Like FOPO, fear of people's opinions. Does that show up for someone like you?
Oh yeah. Tons. I've done a lot of work to transcend that, but it's very present in my life. I mean, my arc has been one of being a prisoner of that. Not just random other people, but you know, my home environment and just kind of the social expectations of the environment in which I was brought up. And I had to, you know, reach some pretty significant pain moments that forced me to you know, confront that in a profound way. And I've worked very hard to craft and cultivate a life that is outside of that rubric, but I'll find myself in a situation like we're in right now. It's like, I want your respect. I want you to like me. What do I need to say and do so that I can covet, you know, favor in the, you know, Michael Gervais universe? Like that's always going on.
So how do you manage that? Like even right now, two friends having a conversation, like how do you manage that?
How do I manage it in what way?
There's I don't know the number of words in, you know, in the English language, but you have all of them available to you. You're a very smart human being. And you've got this tension, you're not alone in this, but you've got a tension maybe showing up in some respect right now, like, okay, well, I want to be found favorable and smart or whatever it might be, but I also want to be me. Mm-hmm. I want to speak truth. And so how do you manage that tension between others' expectations or thoughts versus your own personal truth?
I call myself out on it, like I just did. Like I bring voice to it. Like I'm letting you know that this is part of who I am. And that is integral to what it means to be authentic. Like I think a former version of myself would have been too ashamed or afraid to admit that I would like you to like me or that I want to make sure that I come off well. But I've let go of that. Like I, you know, and part of letting it go is to acknowledge that it exists within me. And the work is really the awareness around it and then the tools to like quell the ego, right?
Yeah, there you go. Okay. When did you first notice that showed up? Other people's opinions were a bit of a constrictor or a narrative that was running a parallel game to how you wanted to live.
That's a great question. I don't know that there was a discrete or distinct moment where that became consciously apparent. I think on a semi-unconscious level, I've always known it was there. Like I grew up in a household where there were certain expectations about how to be and what to do and the trajectory that you were on. And I accepted those. But I also felt, I was also aware that from a very early age that I was kind of like a square peg trying to jam into a round hole. But I was determined to make that square peg fit into the round hole. And I did it and I did it and I did it and I did it until I reached an inflection point, like a crisis point where it just was no longer possible for me to do that.
And to be really concrete, you found yourself working hard. You landed as one of the elite swimmers in the NCAA, the collegiate experience at Stanford, one of the premier universities on the planet. And then you find yourself getting a law degree from one of the premier universities on the planet. So,
and to be clear, I was a bench warmer at Stanford.
Come on, everyone says that.
No, trust me. Okay. I was not putting points up on the board.
Yeah, well, you know
I was proud to be a member of that team.
Okay, that's cool.
And the team won two NCAA championships when we were there. It was an extraordinary group of athletes and certainly a highlight of my life, but I was not, you know, I was not a reason why that team won the NCAA championships.
Okay. Well, I'll give you that. Yeah. Yeah. But that also being said, like it's a statement of talent, work ethic, you kind of biting down and figuring out like how to navigate your early life to get to a premier program, both from academics and athletics. And so it sounds like there was an undercurrent that was also happening for you, which is square peg, round hole. That dissonance, as it's called, is actually quite toxic for people.
Yeah.
And you bounced your head up against the concrete a few times until you finally said, I'm not doing this anymore.
Mm. Yeah, I think that swimming was really my first drug of choice. I think I was a insecure kid who really struggled with how to fit in and how to be. And swimming was a safe place. And it was the one thing that I had any demonstrable acumen or talent in. And I doubled down on that. And I think I saw it as a way out and a way through, as well as kind of this womb-like container that allowed me to opt out of the outside world that was causing some kind of stress and anxiety for me. But I also, it was also the place where I developed drive and confidence and all these incredible life skills, visioning, purpose. I was not the most talented swimmer, but I had this tremendous work ethic. And I figured out that if I outworked everybody, I could narrow that talent deficit gap. And ultimately, it took me to Stanford. You know, I don't know that I would have gotten into Stanford without swimming. Like, it was a huge part of that equation. And it really helped set me up for the rest of my life. But there's also, you know, a story of alcoholism baked into all of that. And, you know, the second addiction and losing myself in substances without any kind of healthy tools for how to cope with this stew of emotions that I was experiencing.
Mm. So this is actually the narrative that sits underneath why I wanted to have this conversation with you now. And you tore it down and built it up. And I'm saying that as if you consciously tore it down. You know, addiction usually isn't consciously tearing mm-hmm. something down. It's like really trying to deal with the internal turmoil because the facing of the pain feels too big, you know? And so I don't want to step into your narrative and story. So I'm being a bit cheap with my analysis here, but you tore it down in a way that you, tell me if I'm being too dramatic or I'm off tone here, but you hit rock bottom. Is that fair?
Yeah.
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 And so you hit a bottom place and then you built this thing back. You reimagined the man that you want to be and become. And back to my first note about your authenticity and your presence and even the humility to say, yeah, I get worried about what you're thinking or others think. So I want to, in the modern times right now that we're facing, shit's falling apart. You know, businesses, family life, mental health, our relationship with nature, our relationship with political ideology, like things are falling apart. And when I think about the people I want to learn from, of how to rebuild from a bottoms experience, I want to learn.
Mm.
So how teach? Like how did you get to the place where you're like, I'm gonna fundamentally change my life?
Pain. You know, pain's been my greatest teacher. We've talked about this in the past.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that I hit bottom. There's plenty of people that can perpetuate unhealthy habits for the course of their life, and it never gets bad enough that they have to really confront themselves at that level of profundity. So to that extent, I'm very grateful that I've hit these moments, these roadblocks in my life that have forced me to stop and take stock and inventory of how I was living. And those experiences have compelled me to ask the hard questions, like, what am I doing here? Why have I made these choices about my career? Who is it that I really want to be? Like, I didn't ask myself those questions until quite late in life. I was in my early 30s when I first started to grapple with that. And in terms of like teaching, like all I can do is share my experience. And my experience is that this was very inelegant and very slow. It required a tremendous amount of patience, a lot of mistakes, and a lot of hard work. And fundamentally, understanding that there are very few things that I have control over, but the things I do have control over are my thoughts, my behaviors, my actions, my reactions to the world. And I devoted myself to focusing on honing those things and trying to attempt to get clear on what it was that uniquely made me me and what song it was that I wanted to sing. And that's a constantly evolving thing. I didn't have an epiphany and then break out a whiteboard and create some kind of roadmap to get to this place where I'm sitting across from you having a conversation. It's very much in the moment trying to be in tune with myself and what would potentially get me excited to get out of bed in the morning.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out. So you speak about it as if it's, you don't make light of it. You don't say it's easy. You're saying it's real hard work and it's not simple, but I think you've got such space from it that those that are in it right now, if you could speak right into their heart, somebody who's really struggling, if you could speak right into their heart, how would you do that? And maybe we could use me too. Like there's places in my life that I'm like, how am I going to figure this out? And I'm supposed to be the person that is supposed to know things. Like,
yeah.
Like, but I'm not immune. I don't have like a, oh gosh, what's it called? When you're sitting on generational wealth and like a trust fund. Mm-hmm. I don't have a trust fund. The economic world is falling apart. You know, I'm making the best informed choices that I can, but I'm trying to keep up with measure twice, cut once,
and, yeah,
you know, like all that. So take me out of it for a minute though. But like, how do you speak to the people that are like deeply struggling?
If you're stuck, if you're struggling, if you're being dismantled, if you feel like your life is getting pulled out from underneath you, I say, congratulations. Like, what a fucking opportunity that is. You are being given an opportunity to look at yourself and reconstruct your life from the ground up. Not everybody gets that opportunity. Like, lean into it. Our instinct is to shun it or avoid it or pretend it's not there. But the truth is, there's this incredible gift if you move towards it. We're here to grow. We're here to learn. And we're taught that our lives, that the lives best lived are the ones that are strife-free, the ones that are free of trauma and tragedy. But that's just not the case in anybody I've met, and certainly the interesting people that I've met. It's that struggle, it's that confrontation with what you're grappling with that is like the stuff of life. And it holds the potential energy to create something entirely new if you're willing to respect it and give it the attention it deserves. When you're in that place, it can feel like you're going to be there forever. But if you devote yourself to that path of self-understanding and you respect the struggle and engage it with everything that you have, I'm convinced that no problem is unsolvable, because I've seen thousands of lives transformed over the years. And so I think it's a beautiful thing. So if you can tweak your lens on it and perceive it through that kind of perspective, perhaps it will energize you to move forward in a different way.
Okay, so how about poetry aside, because I'm listening to every word like, ooh, right, right, right. Rich, I'm about to lose my house. Rich, I've got four kids. This is not me, but I've got four kids. And listen, I'm starting to rip through my savings account. And I've realized that it's about to get real. You know, I had some luxuries because I was doing okay, and I'm over leveraged now, and I'm freaking out, and I'm freaking scared, you know, and I am the person that people are relying on because, you know, I'm providing for my family, single income family. What about that kind of direness, you know, which is like, it's not really dire, let's say, because no one's dying,
right,
but it's that it's hard to breathe type of stuff.
I'm empathetic to that. I've been in a version of that experience. Even after my book came out and there were articles about me being written, you know, on the internet, and I was being celebrated to some regard, I couldn't put food on the table. And we did come within 48 hours of having our house foreclosed. And I do have four kids. And we did have two cars repossessed. It got to the point where we had our garbage bins taken away because I didn't have the $80 to get our garbage, to have our garbage picked up. And so we would put our garbage in the back of this crappy old minivan that we had and look for you know, go behind the grocery store or whatever and throw it in the bins there. So I've been in a version of that, so I don't want to minimize it. And I have some experience with what that feels like. It's incredibly emasculating and demoralizing, and you feel like there's no way out. And I certainly didn't know what the way forward was. But what I learned through that was that, and I don't want to come off as sounding flip in any regard, because this is real life, serious stuff. But it forces you to recalibrate your relationship to the material world and what that means. And I realized that so much of the emotional angst that I had around what I was experiencing was being dictated by a cultural narrative that really is an illusion about what a man is or what a man should own or what success looks like. And Julie and I, you know, I think that's a situation that could blow a marriage apart, but it brought us together and we were aligned in our values. And she was my strength when I couldn't find that strength within myself. And the encouragement that I got from her was to double down on purpose and values and to cultivate, get clear on, and then cultivate what was most important to us. We were lucky enough to find our way through. And sometimes I look back on that and I don't know how we did it because it really brought us to our knees. So all I can say to somebody who is in that place, you know, I can't tell you you're not going to lose your house. And I can't tell you that that won't be painful, but you've always got to find the sliver of learning. And what is it that you're being presented with where there's a growth opportunity for you to reevaluate your relationship with the world and how you interface with it and to get clear on who you really are and what's important? Stuff is stuff. Like when my car got repossessed, I was devastated. And Julie's like, we'll figure it out. You know, it's like, really? I don't know if we can. Like I was freaking out. She was right. But I had to, that had to happen in order for me to reframe what that means as, you know, a man and a head of a household.
What were the dinner conversations about? Like pre-dinner, post-dinner, during the dinner, you know, would you have these conversations at the dinner table with your kids?
Yeah, our kids were young, so we didn't want to traumatize our kids and make them feel like they wouldn't be taken care of or that they were unsafe. But we also didn't want to be dishonest about what was happening either. So we turned it into a game. Like for Christmas, we just made each other get, you know, like we just did creative projects. And I think back on that Christmas, that was the best Christmas. We couldn't afford gifts. So we bought like Hanes t-shirts for $1 and painted them, you know, and did stuff like that. Like stuff that really brought us together as a family. And you know, time will tell how that impacted them and how they'll live their lives. I do know, you know, our boys are older now. They're 25 and 24. And they have a lot of gratitude for that experience because it's helped them understand the value of a dollar. It's helped them understand that you're not entitled to anything. And they saw kind of what Julie and I had to do to rebuild and create what we're doing now. And it all looks like it happened effortlessly, but there was a lot of struggle and there was a lot of work that went into it. And so I think them bearing witness to that has been instructive in terms of how they think about what's required to, you know, create something in the world for themselves.
From the lessons that you've learned and experiences that you've had, how are you porting those over to COVID-19, a pandemic, high uncertainty of both business and health conditions that we're trying to sort out right now?
Well, I think it's a fraught and unique moment that we're all experiencing. Anxiety is running high. Divisiveness is through the roof. Depression, suicidal ideation. I have teenage daughters. I'm seeing them go through it. There's a lot of angst. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of upheaval, some of it necessary, some of it unproductive. And I think it's it's a confusing moment for all of us to try to figure out what the rules of the game are as the tectonic plates of culture are shifting beneath our feet. And it's very disorienting. It's confusing. And it's scary, point blank. On top of that, a pandemic that's killing people and a lot of people are getting sick. From a personal perspective, I'm essentially an introvert. When this all began, I thought, well, I'll just hole up at home. I'm fine. Like I can just do my thing and nobody will bug me. Kind of sounds good. But that's worn thin, and I found myself despairing at lack of contact with my friends. My recovery community moved to Zoom, just like everybody's work situation, and we're finding ourselves staring at screens all day long, and it's hard, man. It's hard. At the same time, I've made sure that I've maintained my health. It's not an excuse to sit on the couch and eat Cheetos. And I live in a beautiful part of the world where I can still go outside and trail run and exercise and do the things that I love. So I'm very lucky and grateful that I can pursue the living that I have and do the things that nourish me. So I'm one of the fortunate ones, but it's paid a toll on me psychologically. And you know, meanwhile, I'm wearing a mask and trying to be a good citizen and trying to take care of my family and the like. And lately, I've been I'm energized by identifying the opportunity. Like now everybody's in repose. Nobody's really doing very much. And I'm like, I'm ready to go. I finished a book during this period of time. We're moving our podcast into a studio. I'm investing in myself. When everybody's afraid, I'm moving forward. You know, it's like, if you're zigging, how can I zag? Where can I find the sliver, you know, of opportunity here that perhaps is being overlooked by other people? And trying to get clear on what the controllables are in a situation that feels wildly out of control.
So, okay. Is that you being a strategist, or is that like you saying, I just feel like I'm onto something and I just want to keep pouring into what feels right to me?
The latter. You know, okay. I know you talk a lot. You're a systems thinker. You think in terms of systems. I really don't. Like, what's your vision? I'm just like, you know what? This feels right now. I want to continue being able to do what I'm doing. I want to get better at it. I'm very much, my vision isn't probably as extrapolated out as it should be. Like, I'm really just kind of riding the wave and feeling what's right in the moment.
What are you doing to take care of your internal ecosystem, you know, your body? What mm-hmm. are you doing to make sure that if you were to come in contact with a virus, that you'd be in a good position?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to make sure that I don't have any comorbidity factors, like trying to be healthy, right? So exercising every day, but not over-exercising or overtraining that I'm running myself down. I don't think that's wise. In the early parts of the pandemic, you would see all these people doing crazy challenges, like running a marathon in their apartment or doing something that's like wildly disproportionate to whatever their fitness level was. And I just remember thinking that's irresponsible right now. Like we don't want to be run down and fatigued. We want to be at our best. So having a balance with the exercise, making sure that I'm getting enough sleep, staying hydrated, using my Whoop to make sure my body's recovering on a day-to-day basis, supplementing with vitamin D and zinc and vitamin C.
What kind of dosage are you on at vitamin D?
I think it's 500 IUDs right now, like a little bit mega dosing just to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, you know, staying at home, restricting my movements to just what's essential and trying to limit my exposure to other people and make sure that my kids are okay.
Mm. Okay.
I don't know. I don't know that I'm doing anything different than anyone else would be doing.
How important is sleep to you?
Super important.
Me too. Yeah.
You know, I sleep in a tent.
No, I did not know that.
You don't know that?
Outside?
I thought we talked about this.
Oh, God. My memory then. You're sleeping in a tent.
I've slept outside in a tent for two and a half years at this point, every night.
With Julie?
No.
No, you guys are sleeping inside.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Okay. But this was driven. I mean, let me contextualize it. Will you indulge me?
Oh, yeah.
So I've struggled with sleep, and sleep's super important to me. If I don't get an adequate night's sleep, and for me that generally means about 8 hours, I don't do well. Like I don't interface with the world well. I'm crotchety. I'm unproductive. And as I get older, it's become more and more important that I stay on top of it. And when I was training for these crazy races, I would just be exhausted. So I'd sleep perfectly fine. even when I was running myself down, I would have a great night of sleep. But I think something about backing off of that, like now my training load is very nominal compared to what it used to be. And I don't fatigue, like going out for an hour and a half run or riding my bike for a couple hours, like it doesn't make me tired so that I get that kind of deep restfulness. Meanwhile, Julie likes the bedroom warm. I like it cold. So there was this war going on where neither of us were ever happy. I'm sleeping on top of the covers sweating. She's underneath extra covers freezing. And we would bicker about this thing. And we have a flat roof at our house. And one summer night, in the summertime, when we would do movie night, like out on the, we have a flat wall, we could project movies and we get out in sleeping bags and like popcorn and spend the night on the roof. And one of those evenings, I just had the most amazing night of sleep under the stars with the cool air at night. And I told Julie the next day, I was like, I feel so good. Like, I'm just going to sleep on the roof from now on. She's like, knock yourself out. But then I would wake up with all this condensation all over me, gets wet and stuff like that. So I was like, I'm getting a tent. And then it just started from there. But I found that my sleep is so much more restful when I'm outdoors.
And that is the combination of slow sleep waves and REM?
REM and my deep sleep cycle
yeah.
is more extended.
Yeah. So do you know the percentages, if you could kind of?
No, but I know when I feel my best, I've gotten a minimum of 2.5 hours in REM and 2 hours in deep.
Well, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Short of that,
I don't feel right.
Okay.
And I also sleep with I have an eye mask and a gravity blanket. You know about the gravity blanket?
I do. I haven't used one. I run a little hot. So I was concerned that if I have a heavy thing on and I'm going to run hot, that I'm going
right.
to find myself
That's
sweating.
Where the cool air is important. If it's yeah. cold out and you're under the gravity blanket,
look at you. Yeah, okay.
But you know what? Here's what's interesting, and I'd be interested in your perspective as a psychologist. When I was struggling with sleep, even when I was sleeping in the tent, Julie said, you should check out this gravity blanket, like this weighted blanket thing. And I was like, sounds weird. She's like, I want you to, and this, correct me if I'm wrong, but these blankets were, the original purpose of them was to treat children on the autism spectrum. And by wrapping them in this blanket, it calmed them down. It chilled out their sympathetic nervous system, right? And told them that they were safe. And she's like, maybe you're on the spectrum. She's convinced I'm like on the spectrum somewhere. I don't know what that means. But she's like, think about when you went to the dentist and you have that lead blanket on your chest. How does that make you feel? I was like, that sounds good.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I was like, you're right. I do need that. And I now have trouble sleeping without it. Like I love it. So I think my nervous system needs it for some reason.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something, it's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course, that's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community,
you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. So what else do you do to damp your sympathetic nervous system? So the sympathetic, to, as a, you know, like a shorthand, is the on mechanism in your body, the fight, flight, freeze. And the parasympathetic is the rest and digest. What do you do to damp down your sympathetic?
The healthy things or the unhealthy things?
Yeah, whatever you do. Whatever your strategies are.
You know, the healthy strategies are to not eat too late, to have no screens in the bed, to have some magnesium, warm magnesium and water at night, like all of these kinds of things to, like,
which magnesium do you take?
The Calm.
It's called Calm. It's called Calm.
Yeah, so that's the brand name.
It's a blend.
Yeah.
A blend of magnesium. Those are big. Magnesium's a big kind of molecule.
Yeah.
So is it like 2, 3, 4, or is it one big one?
I don't even know. Okay. It's like a teaspoon of this powder.
Oh, okay.
Just,
there you go.
Dissolve it in like warm water.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. The unhealthy, like addict brain strategies that I employ are eating very late at night, like right before I go to bed,
comatose.
Because then all the blood goes to my stomach and I pass out.
Yeah.
Of course, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning if I
That's
do
right.
that.
Yeah.
Or distracting myself by watching something on a screen in my bed to calm my looping in my brain, to distract it so that it can become more calm.
So, you know, I'll find myself in loops as well. And this is like, it's not optimal, but it works. And I ran it by a sleep scientist and he was like, yeah, pretty good actually.
Mm.
So I'll use a mask as well. We've got blackout shades in our room, but still got it, you know, kind of comes between the cracks of the blackout shade. So I've got a mask on too.
The Mindfold, what mask do you use?
No, I don't even, there's not a name brand on it. It's like a something my wife said.
I got the Mindfold for you.
Seriously?
You got to check it out.
Okay. All right, cool. And then, so here's the strategy is like, let's say like cycle two, we're 90 plus 90 minutes in, you know, every cycle is about 90 minutes, 180 minutes in and bink, I'm up. Yeah. I feel a little adrenaline because obviously I wake up and the first thing is like, oh, I'm starting to solve that problem, you know, that's important to me. And so usually I give myself a handful of moments, breathe, shut her down, you know, like, okay. And I'll give myself like 4 or 5 minutes, maybe 6, 7 minutes. If that doesn't work, I make a choice. I either get up out of bed or this is just so easy to do. I'll grab my phone, but it's on like red screen.
Did you know about the red screen on your phone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I turn on red screen, so there's no blue light. And I pop in an earbud and I put a documentary on that is boring,
mm-hmm.
but I'm kind of interested in it, but I kind of know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have to work really hard. So usually it's Amazon and I'm doing like philosophy documentaries. And this happened last night. And so I popped it on for a few minutes and 15 minutes of kind of just in that whatever, and then bang, I'm out.
You're out.
And if I don't do that, I end up finding myself like 40 minutes later, God, you know, like, come on, shut her down, breathe, relax, you know. So this is a little bit of a thing I'm using that's been working.
That's cool. I mean, I find that when I wake up in the night or if I'm struggling with falling asleep, it's because I'm caught on a loop where I'm rehearsing some problem that's clearly bugging me. And that not only rents a lot of space in my head, but it's preventing me from getting into that state where I'm going to fall asleep. And if I wake up in the middle of the night, my brain, without intentionally redirecting it, will default to that same loop. So that's where like the documentary or the distraction comes in, mm-hmm. to try to redirect attention away from it so that you can soothe yourself a little bit.
Yeah, it is soothing. You know? Yeah, the soothing.
Reading a book or something, I don't know.
Okay, so sleep is super important. Nutrition, obviously you're on point. You've been vegan or vegetarian?
Vegan for 13 years.
Mm-hmm. And then is the easy question, how do you get enough protein?
There's so much confusion around protein. I mean, that's a whole podcast, and there are people much more qualified to speak about this than myself. But the truth is,
well, I don't know.
Every food,
you're an ultra athlete.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm not the fittest man
alive by mental men's health, men's fitness.
Who knows, man?
Oh, come on!
Believe what you read.
Fittest man's alive. There you go.
Every plant food that you eat has some level of protein in it. Protein is nothing more than an assemblage of amino acids. There are how many amino acids?
I don't know that.
A certain number of them. I think there's.
I know grape has protein.
Everything you eat has those building blocks of protein in them. The 9 essential amino acids are the ones that you have to get from your food. It means your body can't synthesize them yourself. Nature's almost rigged it that if you just randomly graze on plant foods all day long, you'll essentially be taking in 10% of those calories in protein, which is in the range of what is recommended for your daily intake of protein. All I can tell you is I've pushed my body to some pretty, you know, extreme lengths, 53, almost 54 now. I've never had a problem building lean muscle mass. My recovery when I'm pushing myself is really good. I feel good. I remain fit. I'm in the gym now. Like, I'm using this COVID period to work more on strength than I have in the past, to kind of pivot away from the endurance and get back to some functional strength stuff. And I found myself rebounding well and feeling good. And you know, I think this whole protein obsession fascination is misplaced and ill-founded. I think people would be better off worrying about their fiber intake. Mm. I think most people are taking in a multiple of the amount of protein that they need. And your body only needs what it needs and it discards the rest.
What do you think most people would benefit from gut health? Because you're eating the right vegetables to support the lining.
Well, the science that's coming out of microbiome research right now is mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. I just had a doctor on my podcast called Dr. Will Bulsiewicz, who had a book that came out recently called Fiber Fueled. And his whole thesis is we need more fiber. Nobody's protein deficient. Nobody's going to the doctor because they have a protein deficiency. But something like 93 or 97% of people are fiber deficient. And his whole thing is diversity, diversity, diversity. Like the more types of foods, preferably plant foods, maybe I'm biased, the more diversity of of the plant kingdom that you're taking in on a daily basis creates greater robustness and health in the microbiome. And the health of your microbiome is related to all aspects of health, from mental acuity to skin health to digestive issues and everything in between.
If can I ask you to kind of chef me up in a little recipe for dinner tonight? What am I eating?
What are you eating?
Yeah, what are we eating tonight?
How hungry are you?
Yeah, I eat. I enjoy eating.
I keep it simple. Like, the kind of diet that I eat is really pauper food. You know, I eat tons of rice and beans. I eat massive salads. I eat tons of potatoes. Julie's the wizard in the kitchen, but when she's not cooking, I'll make stuff that's like super basic. But you know, all kinds of like chilies, vegan burritos, vegan enchiladas, things like that.
Are you shopping on the kind of end aisles, you know, like the outside of supermarket
or produce, tons of, just stay.
So you're not
produce.
Doing like a Trader Joe's vegan burrito.
No.
In a wrapper.
No.
No. Okay.
But you can go to Chipotle and get a bowl, and it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
rice and beans and lettuce and guacamole and, you know, some hot sauce. I'm good to go. I could eat that every day.
So if you're going to would you consider that a healthy, I don't know, Chipotle, is that a healthy choice?
In the spectrum of what's available,
mm-hmm.
in a convenient way, it's on the healthier mm-hmm. end of the scale. I mean, you know, I would eat, you know, basically like I have a smoothie in the morning that's packed with dark leafy greens and all kinds of produce and mm-hmm. berries and hemp seeds and chia seeds and things like that.
Frozen or?
Sometimes frozen. I mean, if it's organic and frozen, it locks in the nutrients right after picking. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that has a higher nutritional value than mm-hmm. something that came from the farmer's market but has been in your fridge for 10 days.
Yeah.
Big giant salads for lunch, again, with just as much diversity as possible. Mm-hmm. I think always like mixing it up is important.
So you don't eat eggs, right? No eggs?
No eggs.
So I'll do a breakfast. I'll do Ezekiel bread.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a little bit of avocado that I'll kind of put on there. This is my son and I. This is what we do. So we've got that.
Avocado toast. You're so LA bourgeois.
So bougie. Put a little egg on there. So we'll get a nice little egg on there. And then you'll laugh about this. A little Himalayan salt.
Uh-huh.
A little bit of a Nestle oil that we'll put on there for some interesting taste. Olive oil for oleic mm-hmm. acid. And then chia seeds.
Yeah.
How about chia seeds?
I love it. Why did you think I would laugh at that?
Yeah, well, chia.
Except for the egg part.
Right. I know. Damn chickens. And so chia seed.
Yeah.
You know, like most people are like, what? Chia seed on avo toast. But yeah, so that's a go-to in our home.
Yeah.
Like we've got some superfood in there. And then the Ezekiel bread is like a little bit, I think, a little healthier choice for a grain.
You can make chia seed pudding with chia seeds and avocado, and it tastes like the best pudding you've ever had. So easy to make.
Mm. Well, so on that note, it reminds me of the cashew cheese that your wife makes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. What
is
that?
Good.
Yeah.
She's really figured out the vegan cheese thing.
Man. All right. I'm getting hungry.
Coming to Erewhon soon.
Yeah, I know, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's pivot gently here. So we've got some thoughts about nutrition, some thoughts about sleep. And then if you were to help optimize thinking strategies for folks, and that's what I really want to know from you as well, is like, how do you think about something that doesn't go according to plan? Like you tried, you prepared, you were diligent, you put in high effort, and it didn't go the way you hoped.
Mm. You move on.
What do you say to yourself?
You move on.
What do you say?
I'm not in control of the results.
Okay.
You know, it goes back to controlling the controllables. I can control my work ethic, my output, what I put into something. I can't control how it will be received or the end result of that. And the longer I do this, you know, the more, you know, been around for a while, like it just gets easier to let stuff like that roll off your back.
And when you have invested a lot of time, which is an opportunity cost, and you've invested, some resource, financial resources, mm-hmm. and it doesn't go according to plan.
Mm.
How do you manage that?
You allow yourself to feel the natural feelings of disappointment that come with that. But I think through that healthy relationship, between process and outcome. And through mindfulness practices, the half-life of that emotional reaction is much shorter. So you become more resilient and you're able to bounce back more quickly. So it's not that you're not bummed. I'm a human being. If something doesn't go my way, I can be disappointed. I can be upset, but I'm able to recalibrate more quickly and get back on track.
How do you balance for you that space between feel like the half-life being a really quick half-life, right? To a muted callousness for the experience, the emotional experience that's actually happening for you and others.
Meaning denial? Is that a version of denial? Like it's not bad?
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, I think it's what I just said, which is acknowledging it, like acknowledging the validity of the emotional experience that you're having, like not trying to pretend like it didn't happen or that it's not disappointing, right? So if you're allowing yourself to feel those feelings, you're not having a muted callousness to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're in recognition of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a choice about how much you're going to indulge in that.
There it is.
I think it's the it's the recognition, but separating yourself from self-identifying with it.
Oh, there you go. Okay. When you speak, where do you speak from?
When I'm at my best, I'm speaking from the heart, where I'm not, my mind is out of the way.
And when you temporarily fall from that grace, where do you speak from?
I get up in my head and then it all becomes stuttered.
Yeah, I recognize that. Where are you speaking from right now? I recognize that in me.
You're challenging me and you're asking, like as you always do, you ask questions that I haven't been asked before, which forces me to think. So I think I start from the head. And then as I develop a comfort level, I start to let go of that and move more into the heart.
Mm.
I hope. I don't know.
Yeah. So how do you...
You tell me. You're.
I feel that there's an integration in the way that you do it. It's more like the tonation that you have. But only you really know. You know, that's the thing that... We can kind of fool some people, and like I'm a trained observer mm-hmm. of humans, and so I'll pick up some micro expressions better than maybe somebody else,
right.
You know, but only you really know, because you're a sophisticated person, so you know how to get over on people, and you're also deep and rich in the way that you want to communicate the truth, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I don't, I could try to hide behind some vernacular
mm-hmm.
to get over on somebody and it will play.
Oh, for sure it does. Yeah.
But I don't want to do that. But sometimes if I'm not sure I have a good answer to the question, I'll find myself doing that.
It's kind of like, which this is relying on your strengths. You know, so what's his name? Shaquille O'Neal.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? What ought Shaquille do at the end of the game? Put his back to the basket, try to get as close as he possibly can, and turn around and dunk it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's a strength. It's a go-to. But sometimes our go-tos become Achilles' heel or armor to the thing that we really want to do. So how do you untangle the head, the distance, or the web from the head to the heart, and to get more into that place that you want to communicate from?
Like what process?
Yeah, and I think it's instantaneous, almost instantaneous for you.
I don't know if I've ever thought about that. I don't know how to answer that. I don't know if there's an identifiable mechanism.
I wonder if it is the little narrative that you have with yourself, which is like, that ain't right. Come on, man, be real. or if it's like, oh, I know what I'm doing. I'm being the smart rich, you know? Or is
there's
it?
There's definitely both of those.
It's both of those, yeah. And then sometimes I wonder if it's, because you're a physical person, right? Like ultras and like long distance type stuff, pool and running and trails and whatever. I wonder if you use your body and the intelligence that you hold there to shift, to adjust, to get down into a less heady way of communicating or a more heartful way of communicating. Mm. And I obviously the idea is integration, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think my head gets in the way, right? And you know, if I was out running and I just walked in here like fresh off a run, like I'm sure I'd be more grounded and present and speaking more from the heart, right? I have to take actions to get my head to quiet and get out of the way so that I can be honest. But I do catch myself. It's like, am I really being honest? And you know, as somebody who does a lot of interviews and has been interviewed a lot, it's very easy to default to a certain story that you've told a million times. But, and I've done that. I've been on stage in the middle of giving this keynote that I've given a million times. And I'm like, is this even true? Like, like I've said this so many times. I think it is, but when it becomes rote, you become disconnected from it. So I'm always trying to get back to what's real.
Yeah. I want to play that out because I don't think I've ever talked about this, but there's the real experience that took place, and then it's your interpretation of that experience. Mm-hmm. And then each time you remember it, there's a little bit of a distance and a little bit of a mutation. And then when you try to capture it with words, there's a bit of a deeper space and a bit of a mutation to it. And then as you go to, there's a little parts that you want to embellish a little bit or pull back a little bit or whatever. So I have the same question. Like, did I actually fill in the blanks? Like it's, I started telling the story about whatever. Is that exactly how it went down? Right. Or did I find myself migrating away from the truth accidentally? And so memory is not actually a very reliable source of information.
And what is true? Is your interior emotional relationship to an event more true than what actually transpired if you had videotaped it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in listening to your book, you tell the story of going up on stage to present this new theory, right? And you talk about the emotional experience of being prepared for that and getting thrown off your game. And then trying to bring yourself back down to baseline by writing your email on a business card and all of that. And I was thinking, as I'm hearing this, I'm like, I bet he's told that story a lot. Like, I wonder if that's actually how it went down. Only because, and I'm projecting, because there's certain stories that I tell that you then become distant from.
I love that we're talking about this. One, thank you for picking up the book. I appreciate that you...
I loved it.
Yeah, thank you. My friend, I shared that story with my friend and he goes, what are you talking about?
He's like, that's not how it happened.
That's not how it went down.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's up, Peter? And so he had a different experience. Now it was a small trauma for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, to this day, I'm not even quite sure that the legend that I was afraid of was in the front row was actually the legend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually like the art of the story as much as I can feel it in my body when I tell it, like that nervousness, you know, it's still in there, which is cool. You know, I think that people think that we're not supposed to hold things or like be reminded of a physiological experience from something in the past, but I actually like it when I can tap into it.
Yeah.
There's a thing that happens with psychologists sometimes that we become so attuned to the hardships of being and the emotional experiences of others that we in some ways deaden our nerves so that we can deal with the depth, which is the exact opposite of what we want. Mm-hmm. We want to be more attuned and animated in the way that we create more space so we can go deep and feel with them. So I actually like when I don't know where I'm going with this, but I like when I can feel some of my past experiences kind of.
But you're feeling it. There's a very tactile experience to that for you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's true for you, irrespective of how your friend saw it differently.
Yeah, that's okay. I can get down with that. Like multiple narratives, you know, multiple experiences, you know, the same thing. Yeah. This actually happens just about every night with my wife and I talking about like, you know, the day, the stuff we did during the day, you know? So yeah, for sure. Okay. So when you think about your, what you're craving more than anything, and I can hear the Buddhist side of the narrative saying craving is the source of suffering and letting go and all. Okay. But what, if you entertain that for just a little bit, what are you craving?
Craving in its pejorative sense?
Yeah.
Acceptance, probably more than anything. A subset of that being approval and, you know, everything that gets packed into that, probably.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's a function of trauma as a child and not feeling like I fit in or feeling like I was an outsider.
You needed high performance. Your model that you were building at a young age, you needed to perform well to be okay.
Yes.
And then at some point you really realized that that the cost was too high for no matter what the outcome, success outcome was going to be, there was going to, it was an empty experience.
Yes. But I still am a very driven person.
Oh, yeah.
And I approach the podcast and everything else that I do with a high-performance mindset, but hopefully calibrated a little bit in a healthier direction.
When you describe a high-performance mindset, I think there's about six that if we were to create emblems for them or descriptors of them, without saying any of them, like how would you describe your ideal performance mindset?
Focused, intentional, and defined by a work ethic, like a capacity to handle a level of volume that most people can't, and to do that with grace. And an ability to patiently persevere, like to play the long game.
There's the ultra in you.
Yeah. All an ultra endurance event.
It is, Michael. Isn't it? Yeah. last little pivot here is when it comes to being white in a world that is charged in my mind for the a really necessary conversation for us that are humanists and say, this call to action is real and it's right. Okay, so being white right now, being a public figure as you are, and having care for how other people are experiencing their life, and I know you've been talking about it. You know, this has been an important conversation that you're engaging in and holding. So what is it like right now for you to explore this and to explore it publicly and to also be a white male?
It feels, well, exploring it and talking about it publicly feels not only like the right thing to do, but a responsibility that I take seriously. It's a new experience. There's a level of vulnerability with it as well, because I'm not as well versed in this world as I am in some of the other areas that I explore on my podcast. But this is a very important moment right now. And I think it's incumbent upon someone like myself who has a platform and who also is white and comes from a place of privilege to leverage that platform to participate in the conversations that we need to have around race. And it's delicate and it's sensitive. And I'm not always gonna do it right or say the right thing or express myself in a manner that's gonna be acceptable to everybody. So it's very much an experiment in thinking out loud in an environment that is fraught, right? And everybody's sort of on edge and ready to take people out for saying the wrong thing. So I do it with some trepidation, but also with a certain level of conviction. As a white male. I come from tremendous privilege, you know, and my, you know, right out of the gate, I had advantages that most people don't have. And recognizing that and trying to figure out with that how to best effectively communicate around these issues has been something that has challenged me. And I don't know that I'm doing the greatest job at it, but I'm committed to trying. And so I've been endeavoring to have more and more people of color on my show to share their experiences, and to really do it not just from a place of compassion, but as a learner. Like, I want to understand where my blind spots are. And so I've challenged all of these people, like, tell me what I'm not seeing. Like, where is my worldview not aligning with the way that you see the world? And I think in doing that, I'm hopefully, you know, expanding the aperture for everybody who's struggling with how to understand what's going on right now, so that we can move forward as a unified, cohesive nation in a moment that could potentially fracture us. Mm.
Yeah, I feel the fracturing too. I've been surprised by some of my friends who, I think that this might be a true statement, is that, but it's going to be wide sweeping, so I leave myself open for lots of error in here, that not all, if you're down with Trump, doesn't mean that you are a racist. But all racists are down with Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope I'm not offending you here. I offended somebody just now. And so I'm trying to sort out how you are navigating this narrative between your community and upsetting people that are have differing views about the importance of race or not, and people that are clearly coming out of the woodwork in your community that are saying, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Like, this is an overblown political thing. And then other people are like, good job. Like, you know, I think that it's so charging for people right now that the safe and mistake to make is to keep quiet.
Yeah.
Robin DiAngelo came up to the Seahawks, and she wrote White Fragility. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she came up to the Seahawks and had a radical conversation. One of the things that she kind of dropped at the end, when I say radical, thoughtful, deep, rich, we were sharing as a team, learning as a team. She says, white people have conversations with white people. Also have conversations with your people of color. BIPOC is the word I was looking for. They're different conversations, she says. So when you have, when you want it to be emotional and rich and exploratory, have those conversations with your white friends. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa. And she said, it's different. When you're going to try to be a learner with folks of color, that they can't speak for all people of color. They can talk about their experience. Mm-hmm. They don't have all the answers. It's like one person's experience. And it's a different conversation between races. And so it was like almost a little throwaway comment she made. I was like, oh man, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, because there's some backlash, like, okay, what are two white guys talking about this race thing for?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a disorienting thing as a white male. Like, what is my role in this and what is my responsibility? Am I supposed to just recede into the background because this is not, you know, this is not a war that I have experience with, and let other people, you know, for whom this is particularly relevant, take charge? Like, you don't want to make it about, it's not about the white man, you know, it's just not, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, if you're in a position to shape or shift the conversation around these issues, what is your responsibility and what does that look like? And that's what I'm kind of grappling with. And certainly, 100%, there are plenty of people who are like, what are you doing? Stay in your lane. There's plenty of that out there. I don't tune in to you to hear about this kind of stuff. This is a place I come to get away from all of that kind of stuff. And so it'd be very easy to just stay in my lane and do that same thing. But I can't look at my daughters 2 years from now and justify that move. I just can't. It is the right thing to do to stand up right now. And we need these conversations. We need this change now more than ever. It's overdue. And I'm just not going to be on the wrong side of history on this. And if that means that I'm alienating a significant portion of my audience, then so be it. It goes to the FOPO thing. Like, this is, so it's like, all right, I'm in this crucible, but this is my opportunity to really challenge my relationship with needing to be liked and approved. What do I stand for? What is important? What is meaningful? Why am I doing any of this if it's not for the greater good? So all of that has to become secondary to the mission of trying to facilitate healthy, nuanced conversations around things that matter. Because truly, and I believe this, meaningful conversations are the cure to these problems. You've experienced that in doing what we both do. And it's time to double down on that.
Cool, man. Cool. What's the name of this, the segmented show? So it's the Rich Roll podcast is the larger show. And what's the segmented show?
Yeah, we call it like Roll On. I think I should call it Roll Call, though. I don't know. We might rename it. It's like Roll On. So yeah, every 2 weeks we do that. Although Adam Skolnick, who I co-host with, he just had a baby. So it's going to be another couple of weeks.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to say thank you for so much. The time and purposeful conversation that we had today, but also kicking me down this path and igniting the spark of figuring out the value of a podcast and the joy in it. So I want to say thank you for that. And then just the way that you carry yourself. And even though we don't speak on a regular basis, like you're in my consciousness often. So I want to say thank you for all three of those.
I appreciate that, man. You are exactly where you're supposed to be, doing what you're supposed to be doing. So I think your purpose, your values, all of that stuff is lined up perfectly. You are a fully integrated individual and you're truly a gift. So it's just, it gives me great pleasure to not only talk to you, but to kind of witness your work from afar. And I really appreciate who you are and what you do. So thank you.
That's what's up. Thank you, brother. So where do we find you?
Richroll.com is the website, at Richroll on all the social media stuff, the Richroll podcast. I have a book coming out in November called Voicing Change. That's wisdom, timeless wisdom and inspiration from the podcast over the years. I'm pretty excited about that.
And yeah.
That's about it, man.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. Finding Ultra, the first book, if you haven't picked it up, two cookbooks with your wife. And then you said October?
New book is November 10th.
November 10th. Drops. Oh, it's my birthday. Yeah. Yeah, about it.
Nice.
Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
So, I'll drive people in the show notes or wherever to how to get to an early pre-launch.
Cool.
Just when you let me know about that. So, yeah. Awesome, brother. Appreciate you.
100%. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels
is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.